Hello, and welcome to this podcast from the Oxford Institute for Energy Studies.
Welcome to this, the second of a two-part set of podcasts on energy transition from the Oxford Institute for Energy Studies. My name is Dave Ledesma, and I'm Distinguished Research Fellow of the Institute. It's my great pleasure to be joined today by Bassam Fatou, who's Director of the Institute. Now, in the first podcast that was published recently, we discussed the role of energy policy, governments, energy companies, and hydrocarbons in the energy transition. Now, in this, the second podcast, we will address the role of renewables, electricity, electrical market design, and the key factors of financing and finance institutions before addressing key features of the transition and how the world is dealing with climate change. Now, just to timestamp this podcast, we're recording it on the afternoon of Thursday, the 7th of September, 2023. Bassam, welcome back to the OIS podcast series.
Thank you, David, for having me.
Now, in the previous episode, we discussed policy, the role of governments and energy companies in energy transition. But my question is, what about renewables? Surely renewables have matured enough to stand on their own.
The growth in renewables really has been phenomenal. And unlike green hydrogen and CCS and direct air capture, renewable energy forms like solar and wind have already seen a significant decline in cost as they scaled up. But even so, under existing market conditions, government support in the form of risk mitigation instruments is still needed to achieve the right mix and quantum of renewable resources for a variety of reasons. For instance, the price at which renewable generators sell electricity to the grid can vary widely depending on supply and demand. And during times of low demand or high renewable output, prices can go negative. Without long-term contracts, renewable generators are exposed to market risks, making it hard to secure financing. Also, even though renewables have matured, it's important to resolve logistical and technical issues related to the supply chain and grid integration. Much of the discourse around renewables centers on their declining cost and surging capacity. But really, to achieve resilience and reliability, investment is also essential not only in generation, but also in electricity infrastructure. This includes backup generation, energy storage solutions, enhancements in transmission, distribution, as well as demand-side flexibility. And despite overall declining costs, pressures in the renewable supply chain have resulted in elevated capital expenditures for new projects. Project finance with variable interest rate loans may also face increasing debt service costs if interest rates continue to rise, and this will potentially put financial strains on them, reducing their profitability. If long-term contracts do not adequately account for inflation and higher interest rates, renewable energy providers might find themselves in a position where they are selling energy at unprofitable rates or even at a loss. And in light of these financial pressures, some developers have already shown a tendency to withdraw from new contracts, which can delay the deployment of renewable projects. On top of all of this, there's also the regulatory burden. The administrative burden of permitting and regulatory compliance can often slow down the deployment of renewable energy projects. And that is why it's very, very important actually to have to streamline government process, which is needed to facilitate faster market entry for new projects.
Now, Bassam, let's talk about the role of electricity markets and electrification in the energy transition for a few minutes, because design of electricity markets has been the focus of much debate in the aftermath of the Russia-Ukraine war, of course. So can you share your views on this important subject?
The issue of electricity market design has always been important because of the need to encourage investment and innovation in low carbon generation technologies. But the recent surge in electricity prices across Europe and their links to gas prices have brought market design, flexibility, and capacity market issues much more in focus. And there is recognition that electricity will be the cornerstone of future energy system and that the electricity system must be secure, reliable, and affordable. And overall, while renewables have made significant strides in cost effectiveness and scalability, there remains multiple layers of complexity that need to be addressed. And government support in the form of financial incentives, policy frameworks, and infrastructure development could go a long way in ensuring that renewables can sustainably meet future energy demands. So it's only normal that issues of market design and the forms of government support needed will continue to increase in importance as we progress on the decarbonization path.
Now, of course, at the Institute, Bassam, we've been doing quite a lot of research on this subject of electricity market design, and our research and indeed our podcast show differing views. There's certainly a lot of debate around this, but how do you specifically see the role of electrification progressing in the energy transition?
Electrification really is the cornerstone in the journey toward decarbonization. The proportion of electricity in fulfilling final energy consumption is expected to rise significantly, and a substantial portion of this electricity will be generated from renewable sources. There's a broad agreement across various stakeholders about the growing significance of electrification in the energy transition. The real divergence in views lies in the extent and pace at which we can electrify various sectors of the economy, from transportation to industry, because of costs, investment, risk, regulatory, and technological considerations. An entirely electrified system could potentially be less reliable and more costly than a hybrid system, which incorporates both electrons and molecules. That's why some scholars emphasize a holistic approach that recognizes the role of both molecules and electrons, which can yield a more reliable, efficient, and cost-effective energy system. Of course, in a hybrid energy system, the challenge lies in minimizing the carbon footprint of molecular energy sources like natural gas or hydrogen. And there's a huge enthusiasm about electrification, but it's also important to recognize and deal with the costs and investment challenges and the logistical complexities associated with electrification.
Now, Bassam, there are, of course, some challenges that come with electrification. So can you kind of elaborate some of them for our listeners' benefit?
As discussed previously, David, a successful electrification strategy must extend beyond just the generation of electricity to include transmission, distribution, and storage solutions. Renewable generation sites are situated often far from consumption hubs, which requires robust and long-distance transmission capabilities. Also, if the expansion of renewable energy generation outpaces the construction of adequate transmission infrastructure, it could lead to renewable energy curtailment, essentially wasting generated energy. And current regulation and support mechanisms often focus solely on incentivizing renewable generation, neglecting the need for transmission and distribution investments. And this can exacerbate the misalignment between generation and transmission capabilities. There are also technological limitations as well. Moving electricity through high voltage cables is generally more costly than transporting gas through pipelines to be used in power generation. For the same amount of capital expenditure, far more terawatt hours can be moved through gas pipelines compared to electric cables. Also, effective energy systems are crucial for balancing supply and demand. Again, the cost of storing molecules, for instance, hydrogen, is generally lower than the cost of storing electrons, for example, in batteries. And now with the increased reliance on digital technologies for managing electrified systems, one also has to take into account cybersecurity concerns, and these need to be addressed proactively. So it's very important to recognize these challenges, and government policy and regulatory frameworks must respond to these complexities.
So now let's move on and talk about the financing aspects of the energy transition. Now, I think my question is the financial system itself deep enough to enable investment in the infrastructure that's required?
David, there are various estimates out there about the investment needed to achieve net zero targets by 2050. These investment requirements are projected at about 3.5 trillion per annum, or around 1.3% of annual global GDP. And many argue that the global financial system is deep enough to finance the transition. But it's very important to go beyond the headline figures, as these hide some very divergent dynamics and frictions. The issue is not only about the availability of finance, but also whether the available capital could flow to places where emissions could be reduced the most, and where energy access is still a challenge, and also to projects that could be scaled up and achieve cost reductions and reasonable rates of return, so they are able to attract private finance. And this requires massive reallocation of capital to low carbon technologies and critical minerals. And this needs to happen at an accelerated rate. This creates its own challenges in regards to scalability, returns, and also the risk that too much money would end up chasing limited opportunities, which could inflate valuations. Also, how to reallocate capital away from the hydrocarbon sector, which is still very profitable and still generates large cash flows. And generally, you know, this actually creates even macro challenges, because if investment in hydrocarbons is restricted and supply is impacted, while demand is still there, this could result in an increase in energy costs and result in disorderly transition. There is also the issue of allocation of capital to developing economies, which will account for most of the growth in emissions. And I think this last point is really a major challenge and friction that requires special attention.
Well, why don't we talk for a minute about developing countries? You know, could you perhaps elaborate more on the kind of financing capacity issue related to developing countries' investment, and what are the challenges that they face in securing finance for the transition?
In many developing countries, the financing conditions have deteriorated and the cost of borrowing to fund clean projects has risen sharply. And these countries have reduced access to the global financial system, and their local financial markets remain very much underdeveloped. So these countries find themselves in a reinforcing trap. The higher the cost of borrowing and the limited access to finance, the less they can invest in mitigation and adaptation projects. At the same time, many of these countries are being impacted by climate change. This is making them less resilient, reducing their credit worthiness, increasing political and currency risks, which in turn increases the cost of financing and limits the availability of finance. And really, this is a reinforcing trap that needs to break somehow for the world to meet its climate targets and to ensure energy access. And this calls for a greater role for multilateral development banks in order to provide cheaper and more stable sources of climate finance, and in order to allow attraction of private finance into these projects.
So what about the role of financial institutions in the energy transition then?
Financial institutions are expected to play a critical role in the transition because of their financing decisions and policies. Investment managers such as pension funds and asset managers have been incorporating environmental, social, and government-related, or what is known as ESG, in their investment decisions, driven in part by pressures from their investors and the regulators. Banks have also been moving in the same direction, and many have committed to align their lending and investment portfolios with net zero emissions by 2050. And in Europe, in particular, banks are coming under increasing pressure to end their lending to new oil and gas projects. But David, the landscape remains fragmented, and the impact of ESG on financing and investment decisions varies on factors such as the regulatory framework taken by the different jurisdictions. And financial institutions are increasingly reliant on voluntary initiatives and frameworks. And one example is the Glasgow Financial Alliance for Net Zero, or what is known as GFANZ. And GFANZ is particularly interesting because of their four guiding principles, which are expected to shape financial institutions' financing decisions. The first one is financing the development and scaling of climate solutions to replace high-emitting technologies. Second, financing companies that are aligned to 1.5-degree pathway. Third, financing the transition of real economy firms according to net zero transition plans. And fourth, financing the accelerated managed phase-out, example, via early retirement of high-emitting physical assets. And in addition to these frameworks, the infrastructure is emerging to help achieve these targets. For instance, this includes financial disclosure of climate-related and transition risks, green taxonomies, climate scenario analysis, and stress tests that need to be performed by companies. But as discussed, David, many of these initiatives are voluntary and remain fragmented, which raise the issue of arbitrage and standardization. But increasingly, in some jurisdictions, regulators are making such tools more enforceable within the boundary of the regulatory and prudential frameworks.
So, Bassam, are the financial policies and financial frameworks having an impact on investment decisions and bank operations?
Shifting investment and lending policies and portfolios is a process, really, and it will take time and will impact banks' risk-return profile and the financial resilience of their portfolios. Also, there are some challenges. For instance, to accelerate the energy transition, some people argue that it's important to phase out existing assets, even if these are economical and operational. The question is how private financial institutions can finance early retirement of assets and still make returns to their shareholders. Here, there's a bigger role for public rather than private finance. For instance, payments could be made to asset owners or countries to provide them with the incentive to shut in coal plants. An example is the Just Energy Transition Partnership announced at COP26. Also, as they shift from high carbon assets to low carbon assets, such as renewables, banks have to deal with issues of scalability, maturity, profitability, and put in place new frameworks to assess credit risks and bankability of projects. But the momentum is growing and more finance is flowing to renewable projects. At a more general level, there is a wide debate about whether financial institutions should divest or restrict finance to energy companies, or should they engage actively with companies to reduce their emissions. But I think there's an increasing realization that the engagement approach is much more effective than just restricting finance. For instance, this is being reflected in asset managers becoming more active and more involved in board management and shareholder meetings.
Now, Bassam, to end up our two podcasts, let's address some of the wider issues and questions on the energy transition and climate change in general. So given our discussions, you know, what do you think are the key features of the transition that are worth emphasizing?
So, David, this is a massive topic, but let me try to make few observations. First, the energy transition will not follow a linear path. It will be subject to setbacks and accelerations. Also, the energy transition will be disruptive and will result in massive reallocation of wealth, both within countries and between countries. And this will keep the focus on the issue of just energy transition, differentiated responsibilities, loss and damage, especially from many countries from the global south. Also, an accelerated decarbonization path will involve an increased role for governments. This will translate in different ways: setting targets, putting in place appropriate regulatory frameworks, providing sticks and carrots, industrial policies. Also, the expectations of an accelerated decarbonization are shifting much faster than the actual change in the energy mix. And this divergence can result in some dislocations if investments into the existing energy system fall faster or assets are retired quickly, while the new clean assets and infrastructures are not put in place, and if consumers' behaviors don't change fast enough. Also, the speed at which countries will decarbonize will also differ. The speed of the transition will be shaped by multiple factors, including each country's resource endowments, financial and technological capabilities, access to finance, and at what cost, and also different views on affordability and security. And this will have important implications. For instance, some countries may wish to move faster than the Paris Agreement, and as a result, we could see the creation of climate clubs in parallel with the Paris process. And this means that the energy mix will also look very different in different regions, with oil and gas remaining part of the energy mix. And this is why technologies such as CCS and direct air capture will play an increasingly important role in the energy transition. Also, David, some very quick reflections on the geopolitics of the transition. Because efforts to move to net zero, whether they are successful or not, will alter the geopolitical space. And this could be reflected in a number of ways. For instance, we could see geopolitical shifts and change in the balance of power between states. Also, innovation in clean technologies and access to cheap capital, but also access to critical minerals, or they all could become new sources of geopolitical dynamics. Also, if the world is more electrified from net zero sources, how would this impact trade and trade relations? For instance, could we see more shifts from global energy trade to regional trade? These are just really some examples, and one can think of many more geopolitical implications.
So, Bassam, let's look ahead. You know, as we finish these two kind of podcasts in this energy transition series, now, how do you see the world dealing with climate change? Is collective action in danger?
The compelling evidence of climate change calls for providing stronger and efficient incentives for mitigations. And this needs really to happen through well-designed support scheme, stable regulatory frameworks that enable innovation, cost reductions, and higher efficiencies. It also requires fundamental changes in players' behavior. Also, scaling up of investment in low-carbon technologies, new infrastructure, and carbon sinks. It also requires support for adaptation as well, especially for those countries with limited financial buffers and which are impacted the most by climate change. Also, as the world goes through this major transformation, current trends of increased fragmentation, rising geopolitical tensions, and increased industrial competition and protectionism, these need to be reversed. And instead, really, governments should exert every effort at strengthening the COP process and making it more effective and efficient in delivering on its goals. Collective action on climate change is actually needed more than any time. And the alternatives are not clear and might have huge implications. For instance, if we move towards climate clubs, where a group of countries decide to move faster than the rest of the world and start imposing sticks on countries that don't keep the pace, this will come at the expense of more fragmented world and the abandonment of key principles driving the decarbonization path at the moment, such as collective action, just energy transition, and differentiated responsibilities.
Well, Bassam, thank you so much for your time over both these podcasts. And as always, I've really enjoyed our conversation that builds on the kind of key issues facing the energy transition today. As I said at the beginning of the podcast, this is the second of two podcasts that we're recording in September about the energy transition. In the first podcast, we discussed the role of energy policy, governments, energy companies, and hydrocarbons in energy transition. So please do go back and listen to it if you have not listened to it already. So I hope you've all enjoyed listening to this podcast. Thank you and goodbye to everyone.
Thank you for listening to this podcast from the Oxford Institute for Energy Studies. You can find other podcasts, as well as our original research, on our website at www.oxfordenergy.org. If you would like more details about our energy transition, gas, oil, electricity, or China research programs, then please contact us at information@oxfordenergy.org.